I'm John Schumann with Medical Matters. Coming up, an interview with Leslie Kernison, who's a consultant geriatrician in San Francisco and author of the blog GeriTech. But first, a review of the week's health news, including a much-talked-about story on childhood obesity with Gary Schweitzer, publisher of healthnewsreview.org. He's on the line from his home in St. Paul, Minnesota. Hi, Gary.
Hello, John. Good to join you again.
Thanks. Big story this week about children's obesity rates plummeting. Are they really plummeting? 43%?
Yeah, well, that 43% number is what dominated news coverage by the biggies, the New York Times, the Washington Post, USA Today, CNN, many, many others. If you did a search, you'd find hundreds of stories that use that figure. And then you'll find this lone article in Slate magazine, which I applaud, which was headlined, "The Obesity Rate for Children Has Not Plummeted, Despite What the New York Times Tells You." And what they hit on was one of the repeated cardinal sins, in my mind, of much health journalism and health risk communication, and that is the old story of absolute versus relative risk, or absolute versus relative statistics, and I'll explain that. They said the warning signs were right there in the third paragraph of the New York Times story, where they explained. So here we are talking about 2 to 5 year old kids, and they had an obesity rate of 14% in 2004, down to 8% in 2012. So the 8% relative to the 14% is a 43% difference, a relative difference. But we find that what's much more meaningful to people is if you subtract 8 from 14, you get a 6% absolute difference. So it was a difference in 6 out of 100 kids in that time period. That's not insignificant. It still is a significant difference, but it is not nearly the 43% that was trumpeted. It's not wrong to say 43%. It's not inaccurate. I just think it is terribly misleading. And I think that the researchers and the journalists must know what they're doing when they use that figure, because it sounds much more impressive. When you read the study itself, here's what the researchers said in their closing. Overall, there have been no significant changes in obesity prevalence in youth or adults between 2003 and 2012. So think about how this was overstated and how much hype there was.
Well, you certainly named some reputable news sources, New York Times, Washington Post, etc. But if you're an editor, you're probably more amazed by a 43% drop in obesity. That's a big story, but it's not nearly as sexy to say there's only a 6% difference. But nevertheless, there is some good news here, but as you point out, I think most of the media went for the sensational at the expense of probably what the realistic was. And so the Slate article really captured the drop ball by most of the big-name media.
Yeah, and late in their article, they say to readers and to patients, when you read a headline that appears too good to be true, remember, just because it was in a journal doesn't mean that it has proved anything.
Well, it is interesting that the actual researchers themselves say there wasn't a significant change. Nevertheless, I think we're so saturated with news about the rise in obesity that even this little bit of good news probably is some good news. At least we've maybe plateaued in terms of our collective weight. Another thing I wanted to ask you about was the difference a lone blogger can make. And I think there are a couple of examples you have of the lone blogger actually making a real change in some health media policy. Can you explain?
Well, I know you can relate to this. You're a lonely blogger many days. I'm a lonely blogger many days. You send these things out into the ether. You don't know if they make a difference. So I really want to celebrate a couple of instances where clearly little individuals blogging made a difference. So one of them is Paul Raeburn, who's a veteran science writer who runs the Knight Science Journalism Tracker. And he wrote about, because he had discovered news releases appearing unvetted, unchanged, in the health and science section of the Washington Post. And he made a big stink about it, and lo and behold, the Post said they weren't going to do that anymore.
Wow.
So I give Raeburn a lot of credit. You know, and I think that actually Raeburn is just scratching the tip of the iceberg, because I think this has been going on for a long time in a lot of other news organizations. Just after he wrapped up writing about the Washington Post, he he wrote about the Sacramento Bee, Sacramento, California Bee newspaper, sort of not identifying very clearly when they were posting news release material, and that when you did a search on their site, you'd come up with a search result that was a mix of both news stories and news releases. Really not the way it should be in journalism, but it is the state of the art today.
Really sad.
So the other individual was not a journalist. He's a former hospital executive, Paul Levy, who blogs on a site called Not Running a Hospital. But he wrote about an ad campaign for the Da Vinci robotic surgical systems, which are just exploding all over this country. Every hospital wants to have them. And the University of Illinois hospital system allowed some of its doctors to appear in an ad for this robotic surgery system company.
And not just doctors, right?
Right. And so he raised questions about whether this violated the university's code of ethics, and he too got results, because the last we heard on this, after the Chicago Tribune picked up where Levy left off in writing about this, was that the hospital system was going to ask the robot company to discontinue that ad campaign.
What do those Da Vinci robots set you back nowadays? I'm just kidding with you. I think they're over $1 million each. Each robot over $1 million. And there's a hospital arms race to get a hold of those.
And we have many questions that we should be asking about the cost-benefit ratio, but we'll get into that another day.
All right, so we'll keep on the theme of good news this week, or at least getting stories right and calling out badness where there is some. NPR had a story this week on a Kaiser study about, that is, the Kaiser Health System, mostly out in California, sending free home stool test kits to patients. And what happened in that story?
Yeah, and they sent them to patients that went to clinics in a low-income area or served low-income residents in Portland, Oregon. And so they got about a one-third return rate on these home stool test kits, where you look for blood in the stool so the person can take a sample at home, mail it in, the lab does the work. They sent out 213 of them. 81 people sent them back in. Seven of them had a positive result, and six of those seven went on to have colonoscopies. That's a really good news story, because this is a low-cost intervention. You know, it can be something like $15 or $20 a test, compared to maybe $1,000 for a colonoscopy, and a lot of people don't want to go in to have a colonoscopy. So, you know, medicine wants to increase the rate at which they look for colon cancer, but many times in media messages, in both ad campaigns and in news stories and publicity, all we ever hear about is colonoscopy. And I think that there's a harm in that, that we need to remind people there are other ways to look. There's the sigmoidoscopy test, but let's not forget the simplest and the cheapest, and that is these home test kits, which, if they find something, can then lead you to look further with a colonoscopy. So this was something you don't often see in the news, and I applaud Nancy Shute at NPR for reporting on this.
Gary Schweitzer brings us the good and bad in the health news media, and he will be back with us next week. He blogs at healthnewsreview.org. Thanks, Gary.
All right, John. Thank you.
Gary Schweitzer, a longtime health journalist, runs the website healthnewsreview.org. He's been covering health for 40 years. You can catch us on our website, glasshospital.com. Just click on Medical Matters. Keep in touch with us. Send us an email with your comments and questions, glasshospital@gmail.com. Getting old happens to all of us. The vast majority of us don't like it. Those of us that are becoming more infirm or taking care of elderly loved ones struggle with the loss of ability. We fiercely want to maintain our independence for as long as we can. What then are the secrets to aging well? To forestalling the decline that comes with aging while also avoiding over-medication, or what we know in the business as polypharmacy. Our guest today, Leslie Kernison, is a geriatrician who has redesigned her practice to focus on these issues. She was once the medical director of a community health center for those over 60, but she found that the 15 to 20 minute visits that she was given with patients did not allow her to do the job the way she wanted, so she dropped out in a sense. She's become a consulting geriatrician and visits her clients in their homes, Her specialty is providing advice to caregivers about how they can best manage their aging loved ones in the home. She brings to bear many of the newer apps and tools that we doctor types like to play with on our smartphones. She reviews technology as it pertains to elder care on her blog, Jerry Tech. Dr. Kernison spoke with me from her home in San Francisco. Leslie Kernison, welcome to Medical Matters.
Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, absolutely. I want to start by asking you about your blog, Jerry Tech. You're a geriatrician, and I think you're interested in technology, but I would say most people would not think of geriatrics and technology going together. So how did you come up with this concept?
I've always been sort of interested in how new technologies can help us do whatever it is we're trying to do a little bit better, faster, and make our lives a little bit easier. So the idea for Jerry Tech in particular came up partly because occasionally I would have families ask me about some new technology that they had heard about. So for instance, they would say, oh, I heard about these sensors that I could maybe put in the house, and they would tell me if my mother fell, what do you think, should I get them? And I would think, I really don't know. And since I spent a lot of time as a research fellow at UCSF, my initial instinct was always, well, when I have time, I'm going to look in the scholarly literature and see what the evidence is. But of course, there are no papers written about these sensors. I mean, now there are some, but the technology changes more quickly than the experts are able to study how well the new technology works. And so I wouldn't really find much in the literature. And then if I'd Google it, I would just find the marketing materials for these companies. And so I thought, well, there's probably an opportunity here, and it would be neat if we, as clinicians or other people who work on the front line, providing care, health care, and other services to older people, if we sort of wrote about what kind of technology products we came across and tried and what we thought, and we could sort of help each other find our way through this new world of new technologies, which I later discovered are called digital health technologies. And then it also occurred to me that if we started writing about what we thought and describing what we were trying to do and what we were hoping technology could help us with, that this would be of interest and valuable to the developers and the people who create these technologies, you know, who could probably use a little bit of extra information on what it is exactly that we're trying to do as we try to help people.
So you were a fellow for about, you said a research fellow for 3 years. So we're talking about maybe the last 5 or so years. How much has the industry changed just in that short time? I mean, there must be hundreds, if not thousands, of new web apps or, you know, iPhone apps or technologies that are out there available for caregivers to use for their older loved ones.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's changing astronomically quickly. I mean, I forget what year the iPhone came out. Maybe it was 2005. But, you know, first there was the iPhone, and then there was the iPad. And those two technologies have not been around for a very long time. And suddenly, even though not everybody has one, it becomes possible to have these very small portable computers and apps that can do all kinds of things. And then there are all these advances in terms of sensors in the home and a couple other kinds of technologies. So it's changing really, really quickly. And what I discovered when I decided I was going to spend some time learning about new technology and innovations that might be helpful for the care of older adults, I discovered that, you know, right here in the Bay Area, in Silicon Valley, there is this big wave of innovation in digital health, which is partly related to traditional health IT, but partly it's very consumer-oriented or sort of coming from new, smaller companies that are coming up with creative ideas to serve either older adults and caregivers, or sometimes they create products for assisted living facilities. I mean, that's a big industry, senior housing, or for practices or for hospitals. So there's just lots of innovation, and it is changing really quickly. And I think that's a particular challenge for us as experts in healthcare, is how do we keep up with these changes and put ourselves in a position so we can advise the public about the sort of health and safety effects of what people are trying to sell.
So when your client, as it were, or caregiver of a patient asks you about those sensors to implant in the home today, what's your advice now? I mean, do you have specific products or apps that you endorse, or is it on a case-by-case basis?
Well, I don't endorse anything right now, and I don't get paid by any companies to recommend the products or market them. I do hear, you know, I try to follow the sort of industry news, and I go to conferences and events, and I see a lot of products. So if people ask me about something, I suggest something that they might want to try. And I say, well, you could try this. Let me know how it goes. I think it's important, this is kind of a principle of geriatrics, but whenever we sort of think about trying some kind of medical treatment or intervention, it's important to ask ourselves, well, how are we hoping that this will help? And then do we think that this thing we're considering is likely to help? So for instance, sensors. There are a few companies that have created sensor products that can be put in the home of an older person. And I feel like in their marketing, they've implied that this is going to help keep an older person safer. And we really don't know that that's true. And it hasn't been studied, but for instance, for pediatrics, there was a trend a while back of putting apnea sensors in these cribs, and they found that those did not prevent deaths. So, you know, it's not obvious that putting a sensor monitoring something is going to actually improve outcomes. And so when people ask me about that, you know, what I would say is I don't know that it's necessarily going to be the right solution to keep your mother safer. Let's, you know, let's think a little bit about what our options are. Are there other ways that you can know if she hasn't been active or moved? Or if you want to try it, then, you know, try it out and let me know. And you should know that, as far as we know, it's not, you know, we don't know if this will improve outcomes. That's probably what I would tell a family. I mean, I do think it's legitimate to be concerned about an older person who lives home alone. A few months ago, I saw a patient who had fallen at home and lay on the floor with a broken hip for 48 hours. Before a neighbor noticed, he hadn't been in and out and broke down the door. So I think these sensors could potentially end up being valuable, and it's early. We don't yet know exactly how they'll help and whether there might not be a better way to know if an older person has fallen and needs help, or to otherwise keep people as safe and independent as calm as possible.
So that's your role as, I would say, the curator or creator of the Geri Tech blog. You know, you really do write beautifully about the intersection of, you know, geriatric care and technology. You also have another blog, which is really what I would call your business, drkernison.net, in which you have an independent geriatrics practice in what you, I think, call a micro practice, where it's really just you. You make house calls and provide consultative services really addressed almost as much, if not more, at the caregivers than the geriatric patients themselves. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. A couple of years ago, when I was struggling with maintaining a more conventional doctoring job, and I also had two very young children, I thought about, well, what can I do for a few years that would allow me to keep seeing patients and help caregivers and have a little more flexibility? And I came up with this micro-practice where I make house calls and kind of try to fill in where I know primary care doctors often struggle with geriatric issues, because it's really often hard in primary care to address all the geriatric issues because primary care can be so busy and the doctors may not have the time or sort of extra expertise to help somebody with a geriatric problem like memory problems or falls or pain or just general decline and, you know, considering planning for the end of life. So I started that practice, and it's meant to complement existing primary care, not to replace primary care. And it's true that most of the people who call me up are adult children of an older person who are kind of worried about how their mom or dad is doing, and they're interested in having me take a look and either help with a specific problem that they feel the other doctors haven't addressed as thoroughly as they'd like, or they just feel like they'd feel better if they knew someone else had taken a look and reassured them that there wasn't something else that could be done to help their mother or father have, you know, better quality of life and well-being. So that's not, you know, explicitly a service for caregivers, but it's usually family caregivers who call me up and are interested in my coming to see their parents. And then along with that, I've been interested for several years in providing geriatric education to caregivers. This is something I fell into when I was a research fellow. I was researching how we might improve the quality of primary care for frail and vulnerable older adults. And I've been studying quality measures, and then I met somebody who was writing for a caregiving website. And she asked me would I be interested in answering a few expert questions. And since I had a primary care clinic, for older veterans at the VA in a geriatric clinic. I thought, well, if there's a good resource that's going to give caregivers information, then I would love to know about it. You know, maybe this is something I should be telling my patients about. But then when I took a look, you know, it was for people worried about aging parents. And there was a lot of good information, but I felt like the health information could be more oriented towards geriatric. It was kind of stock standard health information. And I got kind of excited about that. I thought, wow, all these caregivers are looking for health information, and we geriatricians could be creating articles or materials that would help caregivers learn a little bit more about geriatrics, and that way they could maybe be empowered to get better care for the person that they're worried about, and that this might be another good way to improve the quality of care for older people. So, well, yeah, that thought of myself as somebody who also focuses on caregiver education. But I thought, well, you know, my practice is kind of about educating caregivers, and so I'm going to start blogging for caregivers on my own website and, you know, think about how we might create maybe some kind of online curriculum in which we could help caregivers learn about health topics related to healthcare for older people. That's what I have on my own drkernison.net website. Right now I kind of have two blogs, one that's really more oriented towards caregivers in the lay public, and then on GeriTech was written, you know, more to be shared with my clinician colleagues and people who are a little bit more in the business or industry somehow of providing healthcare.
Do I understand correctly that your practice model changed essentially? You alluded to the fact you were in a more conventional style medical practice where patients came to the office and things like that, and largely it had to do with the constraints of the fee-for-service model where, you know, you had to essentially, or we all have to as physicians for the most part under fee-for-service arrangements, see patients in an office visit setting in order for their insurance to pay for the visit, rather than paying for our time or for the quality of the care that's delivered over a time frame. Is that what you experienced?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. The clinic where I used to work, and I had actually become the medical director for the site, was a federally qualified health center, which they also call community clinics. And all the doctors at such a clinic are salaried. We just get paid a salary no matter what. But the clinic itself only gets money from Medicare and Medicaid or private insurers when a doctor has a face-to-face visit with a patient. So even though we were salaried, they would still keep track of how many people we saw every day and really push us to see at least 11. But I think the goal was for every doctor to see 11 to 13 patients per half day. When I pointed out that I was a geriatrician and my patients were older and needed more time, they said, yes, we know, we love what you do, and the government does not have a productivity standard for geriatricians, and you're still really supposed to see 11 people per half day. And that's a challenge. I mean, I think most primary care doctors feel that the pace is intensive and hard to sustain. There was a survey showing that there's quite high burnout rates among all primary care doctors. And I don't know that it's been studied for geriatricians, but I do know that most of the time for geriatricians to do the work that we're trained to do, you really need to find a special clinic setting that provides you with more time and more resources. And most of those clinic settings have special funding or are subsidized in special ways, either by an academic center or there are a couple other models that create extra funds. To focus on geriatrics and have a primary care as usual environment is harder, financially harder.
So what are some new ways under the Affordable Care Act that we'll see healthcare, especially for geriatrics, being paid for that will change the high volume necessity into something that's higher quality? Are those new models something that you're familiar with or keep up with?
You know, I haven't focused so much on the Affordable Care Act. It didn't seem like initially that there was going to be a lot of impact on Medicare in the outpatient setting. There have been some changes in how Medicare pays hospitals, which does affect older adults. But in general, the trend is to move towards a way of paying doctors for what they call value instead of time. And I think eventually we'll see that come into Medicare and become more of a factor in the care of frail older adults, and so that could change geriatrics. There are some, you know, models of primary care or outpatient care for older adults that I like a lot. There's a model called Program of All-Inclusive Care for the Elderly, the abbreviation is PACE. And the first one was pioneered here in San Francisco, actually. It's called UNLOC. And it's a medical practice for very frail older adults. You have to be eligible to go to a nursing home. And what they do is they have a special waiver to use your Medicare money and combine it with Medi-Cal money. So it's mostly people who are eligible for Medi-Cal along with Medicare. But they combine the two of it together, and they create these senior centers that have an activity center and a medical clinic together, and also have physical therapy on site, and pharmacists on site, and nurses and doctors, and the care is provided by this team. And the clinic even brings the older people into the clinic and activity center several times a day. So that's called PACE. And PACE has had great results these last several years. They're just trying to figure out how they might expand and be able to serve people who aren't on Medi-Cal or maybe aren't quite as frail. And I think states partly are willing to pay for PACE programs because the alternative is for the person to go into a nursing home, and that's much more expensive than being in such a PACE clinic. So that's one model of care. And then I know people are sort of experimenting with others, but I haven't heard of anything that is widespread that is doing fee for quality for the primary care of Medicare, other than something like Kaiser. You know, Kaiser has Medicare patients, and, you know, they're an integrated HMO, so they're very invested in, you know, making sure that they take good care of people because it comes out of their pocket when people get hospitalized. Not that that's why we should provide good care to people, but often the finances are an important driver.
Kaiser, you're referring to the mostly California-based, although in other locations, HMO that's thought to be highly efficient, Kaiser Permanente, as it's sometimes called, where either patients or the companies they work for pay in, and it's, right, it's an HMO model, so they, instead of care being paid for on an episodic basis, it's paid for essentially in advance, so the emphasis is on prevention rather than on sick care, so to speak, which is how most care is delivered.
Yeah, and the advantage that a place like Kaiser has over just an HMO insurer is that they own all their facilities, and so it's the same organization running the insurance and the hospital and the primary care, and so they can connect it all together, and that's called being vertically integrated. The VA is another example of a system that is similar, whereas otherwise if you have HMO insurance, your HMO is contracting with a hospital, which is part of a different group than your primary care doctor, and so that's the care can be less well coordinated because of that.
If you're just joining us, I'm John Schumann. This is Medical Matters. My guest today, Leslie Kernison from San Francisco, who is an independent geriatrician. She blogs at geritech.org about the interface of geriatrics and technology, enabling more advanced practice, and at her own self-titled site, drkernison.net, where she provides consultative services for geriatrics and also for their caregivers, and provides a great deal of information aimed directly at caregivers for geriatric patients. And Leslie Kernison, you, I guess rather famously now, sort of opted out of the Medicare program when you went into your independent or micro practice, as you call it. It's a low overhead practice that really just consists of you and your tools, essentially, I guess, iPhones and laptop computers. And you were featured in the New Old Age blog of the New York Times, where the writer, Judith Graham, you know, portrayed some of your reasons, and you alluded to this earlier, that you were very busy, expected to see what seems like an extremely high number of patients, given that your patient population was all, you know, older than 60. You know, on average, usually geriatric patients have many more medical problems and are on many more medications, which in turn create their own sets of problems. And that's one of the things you've written a lot about, is dangerous medications in the elderly, or what we call polypharmacy. But the reaction to that article was somewhat surprising. It was sort of split. I mean, I think some of the commenters were very much in favor of you, you know, caring for yourself most of all, because it sounds like you were, you know, undergoing, you know, it was very personally challenging for you with a young family, whereas others were more critical of you as sort of opting out. How did you feel when the response came so negatively?
That was hard, reading all those comments, and made me a bit sad, although I can see why the average stressed caregiver reading a short story about a geriatrician who has opted out can feel greater stress and anxiety. And I think, I wonder if the reaction to the story would have been different if it had mentioned that my practice was quite part-time and that I was spending most of my time, you know, writing, basically on my own time, writing about geriatrics and technology. And I've written a lot of thought pieces for the healthcare blog about the work of geriatricians, and then also, you know, continuing to write and create content about geriatrics for caregivers, basically health information that focuses on what we know in geriatrics and put in a readable format for caregivers and put out to the public. So I do get asked that a lot, you know, about why am I opted out? How can I be a geriatrician and have opted out? The main reason why I opted out was that when I thought about what kind of small part-time practice I could have for a few years while I stepped back from things a little bit and took care of my young children and figured out the next steps in my career, when I thought about the kind of practice I want to have, I thought, well, I feel like ideally a geriatric practice, you'll be able to spend a lot of time on the phone coordinating care with other doctors, because most geriatric patients, and when I say geriatric, I mean somebody who is not just over 60, but has really started to become frail from all the chronic illnesses that they have, or just from being quite advanced in age. So in an ideal geriatric practice, I think you should be able to spend a lot of time coordinating care, which means touching base with other doctors and trying to put together everything that's happening, because many of these patients are seeing lots of other doctors, and nobody is able, because the primary care doctor never has the time to sort of knit it all together. And then I also thought that it would be useful to have a practice where one could do follow-ups by phone and email and video. And I love seeing people in person, and I think it's very important to have that in-person visit. And I do go into people's houses, which is great because then you see where they live and who's around them. And at the same time, often I feel that after you've had a really good in-person visit, you don't necessarily need another in-person visit to follow up on what's going on. It might even make more sense to have a properly planned phone check-in after a week. And so, for instance, if I see an older person and they have pain and I examine them and we come up with a plan to manage that pain, what happens often in the conventional system is that they're told to come back in 3 months. And it's very hard for them to get through the clinic if they have concerns or more pain. But the idea in my mind was to say, well, why don't we talk by phone in a week? And I want you to keep track of how many times you take the pain pills or how often you have the pain. You know, I want you to keep track of a few things. And then when we have, you know, our call, you'll tell me about that. And I'll tell you the next thing to adjust so I can answer your questions and concerns about side effects. And I actually think this is the way, you know, primary care is moving to, and we were talking about Kaiser Permanente earlier, the comprehensive healthcare system that we have here in California, but Kaiser doctors do a lot of follow-ups by phone and email. And so I wanted to do something similar. And to do that, the only way I could really do that was to opt out, because Medicare does not pay for your time as a doctor on the phone coordinating care or for a phone follow-up, or if they do, it's under very, very restricted circumstances. So I have a practice where I promise to call people back within 2 hours, or I write back to them by email or by secure portal, which is better, but most people prefer email, within a day. And I'm able to do that in part because I'm not packing my day with face-to-face visits or driving around all the time trying to pack in face-to-face visits. And so to do that, I really had to opt out. And I was sad to do it. But in order to have this small part-time practice for a few years, it's just what made sense.
And do you see colleagues choosing to go your route? Or do people come up to you at these meetings and, having read your materials, do they, you know, see this as a way forward for their own practices? Or are they just sort of happy to have you as a role model and see how your experiment is faring?
I have been contacted by a number of younger doctors, some of whom are geriatricians, who want advice because I think they're feeling those strains of wanting to do their work in a certain way, having work conditions that are really not hospitable doing that kind of work that they want to do. And then often the additional kind of stresses of being younger and being just married or thinking about having kids or having had a kid and trying to figure out how to put it all together. So I'm contacted by younger doctors. who I think, you know, likely just need a sympathetic ear and are trying to figure out what their options are. Otherwise, most geriatricians that I know are either in academia, where they have faculty positions, or they're in those clinics where they have a lot more support, although I did once get called by a young geriatrician there, and, you know, even with all the additional support, she was feeling fairly burned out. So I think it's better to be there than in a very recovering care clinic, and the work can still be quite demanding. Or there's a sort of other generation of older geriatricians who are often in private practice, but they've been in practice for a long time, and I think they're mostly seeing patients who they've known for a long time, and that does make your work easier as a doctor if you've known the person for a very long time. Whereas when I meet someone, or when I used to be at my previous clinic and would meet an older person, I would have to spend tons of time for figuring out their backstory and all those things that had happened to them medically over the years because they were neurologists. So that is what I would say for geriatricians. Separately, I think there is a crisis going on in primary care, and there are more and more doctors who are choosing to change the way they charge patients. Sometimes they leave practices and start new direct pay practices from scratch where they might charge people a monthly fee for all the primary care they want, or sometimes they just charge per visit. Or other doctors are doing what is sometimes called a hybrid model, where they continue to accept insurance, but they charge an extra annual fee to sort of cover extra customer service. But I think it's, you know, gives a little bit more space to do the work that they want to do. And sometimes that extra annual fee is what I would consider fairly modest. We have a line of clinics in San Francisco called One Medical, and they accept insurance and then charge $149 a year extra, no matter how old you are. I think that's quite reasonable. I've actually referred some of my geriatric clients who were struggling with their current primary care doctor. I've had some of them switch to One Medical, and they've been happy with that switch. But then there are other primary care doctors who send their patients a letter saying that now they're going to charge an annual fee that's more than the order of $1,000 or $2,000 or sometimes more. So I think we are seeing a shift coming in primary care.
I was looking at your caregiving blog, drkernison.net, your self-titled blog, and there was an article there recently about things that promote dementia, I believe, or things that can prevent dementia, and I was wondering if you'd be willing to comment on that.
Sure. That post was actually inspired by my observing in San Francisco a public question and answer session at the public library. And a friend of mine, a friend and colleague who is a social worker with extensive experience working with families affected by dementia, she used to be at the memory clinic at the VA hospital, that's where I met her. She did a free question and answer session to answer people's questions about how to manage behaviors when a person has Alzheimer's or another dementia. And people did ask some questions that were medical or for the doctors regarding treatments and how one might keep Alzheimer's from getting worse. And so I decided to write about a condition called delirium, which is when their thinking becomes worse than usual, fairly suddenly, usually on the order of hours to days, the thinking becomes worse than usual and they become more confused than usual. And this is really common in people with dementia, although it can happen to anybody if they're sick enough. And I think many of us may have known somebody who their thinking is normally quite fine, and then they end up very sick in the hospital, and they become very confused. And so that's called delirium. And I have found over the years that caregivers often have heard of a lot of things that might be helpful to prevent Alzheimer's or delay Alzheimer's, but they almost never have realized that delirium can really speed up Alzheimer's, and that avoiding delirium or recognizing it quickly and getting it treated might be helpful. So I wrote a post about that, and I think that's a good example of the kind of information that I think we as geriatricians could be helping caregivers learn, because the sort of quality improvement level, as I mentioned, I used to study quality improvement. I did a quality improvement research fellowship several years ago. It's been proven that delirium is often missed by doctors and nurses in the hospital, and that delirium is very common in older people in the hospital, and that it's linked to bad outcomes. People stay in the hospital longer, and they do worse afterwards, and it turns out that it can speed up their Alzheimer's progression. So on one hand, as you know, geriatricians interested in quality improvement, there's been this issue of, well, we've got to get the doctors and the hospital staff to recognize delirium and to, you know, try to prevent it. But when I found that website for caregivers, I thought, oh, I mean, who better to recognize delirium than a caregiver? They know just what their loved one is usually like. And they usually notice when they're different. But what they don't know is they don't know what to do. They don't realize that doctors often don't notice. So people often assume that we know all these things as doctors or nurses that, in fact, we may not. Or they don't know how to ask if medications have been checked. And so I just felt that there were all these things, sort of practical information that we could tell caregivers, that they're very invested and motivated, and if we just could give them some tips and suggestions and health education that was specifically about how health problems come up for frail older people, that is an additional tool on improving the quality of care overall, but also giving people the tools to participate more actively in their medical care or the medical care of their loved one and be more proactive.
And there was a takeaway in terms of the only thing we know about that actually can forestall dementia or perhaps stabilize it is, I think, exercise, right?
Exercise right now, it seems like, has the best data. But I think it hasn't been studied, but it is hard to study preventing delirium as an active intervention. But in my blog post, I sort of reference a study that found that for older people who had delirium in the hospital, their thinking abilities declined twice as fast in a year after hospitalization as people with dementia who hadn't had delirium. Now, it's possible that if we can't get to the exact causation, but there's no intervention like exercise that's going to keep people from declining twice as fast. So I think it's been sort of undersold delirium prevention.
We're nearly out of time, but I want to throw some numbers at you. Since January 1st, 2011, by census data, 10,000 baby boomers, more than 10,000 every day, turned 65. And also, I guess the total number of geriatricians in the U.S. is right around or slightly less than 8,000. So as the architect of the Geri Tech blog, I think of you as a futurist, at least at the intersection of geriatrics and technology. How are we going to take care of the gray tsunami that is occurring in the U.S.?
I think the answer is to find ways to bring geriatric expertise and approaches to healthcare without expecting it to be delivered directly by geriatricians, because there are not nearly enough geriatricians, and there's no way that there will be. But what I would like to emphasize to people is that geriatric care can and should be provided by non-geriatricians and those above professionals, and also caregivers, and also older people themselves. And so when I say geriatric care, what do I mean? I mean medical care that has been sort of adapted and modified to be a better fit for the kinds of health problems that come up as people become older and frailer. And what comes up as people become older is they are more physically vulnerable to illness. They're more mentally vulnerable to the side effects of medication or to getting delirium. So that vulnerability means that we have to be more mindful of the side effects of things. And it also means that certain common illnesses, like a urinary tract infection, show up with different symptoms in somebody who's older than somebody who's younger. Also, as people get older, they tend to have lots of illnesses at the same time, and so that means that you can't really take an approach where you sort of offer the best expert care for each of their diseases in parallel, because that doesn't work. You need to switch an approach that kind of sees the forest for the trees, where you sort of step back and help an older person in their family look at what's going on overall, and prioritize, basically. You have to pick a couple of things that you're going to focus on, and it should be a function of what's going on in the person's life, and most important to them, what they're going to prioritize. Often as people get older, they prioritize being able to walk around and kind of manage daily living tasks, which in a way you can't take for granted quite the same way when you're older as when you're younger. So that kind of approach and knowledge base, you know, I think technology can help us bring it, you know, to more people. I can certainly envision a time where technology might, you know, when an older person has a health concern, some kind of tech tool might bring up the right questions so that they can prepare sort of what's been going on with them and bring that to a doctor and might remind the doctor to sort of approach it in a more geriatric-oriented way than the way they would have done for younger people. So I think that approach we use as geriatricians can be implemented by other people, and I think technology can help. But I think to do that, since we have limited geriatricians, some of us should be there trying to figure out how to leverage our expertise to reach a broader group than if we were in clinic just sort of turning through people one at a time. I think it's doable, but I think it's certainly a big challenge.
Leslie Kernison is a geriatrician in San Francisco. Her new model of practice, providing consultations to caregivers, was featured on the New Old Age blog of the New York Times. She edits the blog Geri Tech, which looks at caring for elders using enhanced technologies. Aging and Medicare are two sides of the same coin in the United States. Since the Medicare program began in 1965, it has become the most popular government program for Americans over 65. When the first of the baby boom generation began turning 65 in 2011, the gray tsunami was upon us. More than 10,000 Americans turn 65 and are thus eligible for Medicare every day. Here, commentator Janet Pearson shares her experiences with the process.
It was one of those crisp, cool year-end days, the kind that makes you want to sit out on the deck and have a second cup of coffee to enjoy the warmth of the sun on your face and indulge in sweet, simple fantasies about how to spend the day. Spending it sitting in a crowded Social Security office hadn't made it onto my list, but when my husband reminded me that we needed to get him signed up for Medicare, I realized he was right. So off we went, loaded with plenty of reading material and electronic gizmos. When we got there, I was instantly struck by the diversity of the people waiting to be assisted. There were people with obvious physical limitations. One man was missing an arm, and quite a few people were using canes, walkers, or wheelchairs. Many of the people waiting were in their 60s or older, no surprise there. But what was surprising was the number of younger people waiting. There were some new parents with infants and toddlers. There were multiple generations of extended families. There were also people wearing clothing and speaking languages that suggested they were originally from other countries. Out in the parking lot, there were little knots of friendly strangers passing the time by making small talk. One family made the best of the long wait by holding their own little tailgate party. This wasn't exactly the idyllic interlude I'd envisioned earlier, but it was nonetheless a thought-provoking experience, a routine happening, yet profound and extraordinary at the same time. It was a snapshot of America at its best. A few hours in a real-world, honest-to-goodness melting pot, if ever there was one. It was even a bonding experience of sorts, and for some reason it made me feel good to be an American. As we waited, I tried to guess why each person was there. And goodness knows I had the time, since we drew ticket number Z48, and the number being served when we arrived was Z12. Obviously, some of the people there were applying for disability assistance. Some, like my husband and me, were signing up for Medicare, and undoubtedly some were there to get their Social Security benefits started. I figured there was at least one name change in the offing, judging from the Just Married announcement on one of the cars I saw on the way in. No matter our reasons for being there, I finally concluded we all shared one obvious commonality. We were there to get some kind of government help. Help that we had earned and that we as American taxpayers and voters had made possible for ourselves and others. How odd, I thought, that this scene was so routine and uncontroversial. While another initiative that compares to Social Security and Medicare is as controversial as it gets, the Affordable Care Act. Why do so many Americans feel it is not only acceptable but moral and proper to make health care readily available to certain citizens, the elderly and children, for example, but not to other Americans who need that care just as urgently? I know, there are those old bugaboos about socialism, and some people have a fiercely held belief that government can't do anything right. Last fall's rocky rollout of the ACTS enrollment element certainly helped bolster that argument. But the question still nags. Why is socialized medicine okay for some Americans but not for others? And if the government can't do anything right, why are programs like Medicare and the Veterans Health System held up as models for how to provide effective, efficient services to staggering numbers of people? Sure, those programs aren't perfect and they've weathered major controversies over the years, but Medicare and the Veterans Health Administration indisputably provide affordable and usually adequate health care services to tens of millions of Americans, many of whom would have no other access to health care. What's more, both systems generally do well in surveys of patient satisfaction. Apparently, the government can do some things right. I couldn't come up with a completely satisfactory explanation other than politics for why one established health care program is well regarded and a similar brand new one is held in such contempt. And since people watching tends to be more interesting than policy mulling, I went back to my waiting room study. The room stayed full the entire time we were there, offering plenty of stories to occupy my thoughts. When I was thinking about how the day would unfold while enjoying my coffee on the deck that morning, a lesson at a political science laboratory never came to mind, but that's what I got.
Janet Pearson, formerly of the Tulsa World, spent nearly 4 decades in the newspaper business. She's now branching into other forms of media. You've been listening to Medical Matters. I'm John Schumann. Our program is produced and recorded at the studios of KWGS Public Radio Tulsa on the campus of the University of Tulsa. Medical Matters is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The show's theme music is by Europa 51. Original music during the broadcast is by Scott Griffith. Join us next week as our topic is The Upstream Doctors. We interview physician, author, and social activist Rishi Manchanda. For more information, check out our blog, glasshospital.com. Just click on the Medical Matters tab at the upper right. Questions or comments, send us an email at glasshospital@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Tune in here next week.